Hi, welcome to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, and welcome to our Re-Air Summer. Summer is associated with transformation, personal development, and a sense of renewal before the new academic year begins. Our team at Stanford Psychology Podcast decided to take some time off, but don't worry, we are not going into radio silence. Instead, for every week until September 20th, we will air some of our favorite episodes around the topics related to personal development and self-improvement. We hope you will like it, and please don't hesitate to be in touch if you have any ideas for how our show can be improved in the new academic year. Thank you so much, and here's the episode.
Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast. This week, it was my pleasure to chat with John Yahimovic, Assistant Professor of Organizational Behavior at Harvard Business School. Yon studies people's passion for work, especially how people can pursue, fall out of, and maintain their passion over time. He also studies how people perceive inequality. Yon has won numerous awards and was listed as a Poets and Quants 40 Under 40 honoree and Forbes 30 Under 30. In this episode, we chat about passion narratives at work and in life more generally. Yon discusses his new, not yet published research on how passion one day can lead to more work on that day, but cause exhaustion on the next day. Yon argues that people do not have a fixed level of passion and that the link between passion and productivity is more complex than we might think. He then discusses how to maintain passion in the long run, at work and outside of work. Should we even pursue our passions? What does it mean to engage in passion shaming? How can passion narratives lead to more inequality? Do passion narratives vary across the world? Hope you enjoy our conversation. I am so excited today to be talking with Yon Yahimovic about passion. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did. I mean, passion is not that hard to say. So I'm not really sure why you were struggling with that word, but thanks so much for having me on the show, Eric.
All right. It is wonderful to have you on, and thanks so much for taking the time. Passion. My God, what a buzzword. Everyone's talking about passion. Everyone has their own hot take on passion. Before we talk about your hot takes on passion and your research on passion, what is passion? How do you define it? And how did you become interested in studying passion?
So let me take the latter question first and then the first question latter. I'm originally from Germany. I actually did my undergrad and master's degree in the UK. And I was super passionate about trying to understand why people are struggling to make ends meet and why society is set up in such a way that makes it more challenging for some than others to thrive. So particularly like the way that I think we talk about this in social psychology is to think about social and economic inequalities and the way these are interrelated, as well as like this emerging stream on scarcity research. And I was so passionate about this that it propelled me across the Atlantic, that I took a leap of faith. And I was really grateful and fortunate to be accepted at Columbia to get my PhD. And Elke Weber, who's like one of the most amazing researchers in the world, she agreed to work with me while I was at Columbia. And, you know, like for someone who's passionate about this kind of work, like, this is a dream come true. Like you are at the central hub for this kind of work. And I was doing the work, I don't know, 9 months, 10 months, 11 months, 12 months. And bear in mind, like I, you know, moved to New York. I'd left behind everybody that I loved. I didn't know anybody in New York. This was a completely foreign place to me. And after about a year's time, I remember vividly this one day that I was staring at my computer screen, working on something or the other. And that passion that propelled me across the globe, I just didn't feel anymore. And that was a really disconcerting feeling, because I had given up so much to be there, and I was supposed to feel really grateful and fortunate to be there. And, you know, I'd taken up someone's spot to be there, and like that passion just wasn't there. And so that really had me in a tailspin, and I didn't know what to do with myself. And after like a couple of days of hiding that, I finally disclosed that to Elke, and she said, "Oh, don't worry. Like, that happens. Like people lose, you know, researchers lose their passion for their topics. It'll come back." You know, and for someone who was going through like an identity crisis, that was not enough of an answer. And so I asked other colleagues and friends, and I said, "Look, have you ever fallen out of passion? And if yes, like, what do you do about it?" And every single person that I talked to seemed to say something along the lines of, yes, it happens. Yes, it's normal. And don't worry, it'll come back somehow. But we don't know how, and we don't know how long. And you're just going to have to deal with it. But that's just what it means to be a scholar. And that was just not enough for me. Like, I'd given up too much to be there. And I was just in a state of agony. And so I did what any researcher in my position, I believe, would do. And I started reading the academic literature. And the academic literature, the way it talks about passion, is it primarily talks about passion as something that is relatively static, relatively trait-like, as something that people either have or don't have. And so, sure, while there's some variation, the variation usually stems from people selecting jobs or occupations that allow them to pursue their passion or not. That's like one of the primary sources of variation that you see. So relatively, like, yes, there are changes, but they take a long time, relatively slow. When people, like, what people do or what people care about changes, which, you know, is relatively slow. But this wasn't my experience. Like, my experience was very different because what I cared about hadn't changed, my job hadn't changed, and still I felt less passionate. And so I did the second thing that a researcher in my position would do. I started talking to people, and I asked every single person on my network, and I said, listen, who's the single most passionate person that you know? And can you connect me with them? And can I talk to them? And being in New York, you're also at the hub of people pursuing their passion. Like, you moved to New York because you're some crazy person who has some passion that they're trying to fulfill. And people put me in touch with the most passionate people I have ever met. And, like, you know, hierarchy doesn't matter. I talked on the one hand to, of course, like, people super high up in the hierarchy, like Fortune 500 CEOs. But I also talked to people like at lower levels of the hierarchy, people that, like, from the outside, we wouldn't necessarily think, quote unquote, like, would have a job that would allow them to pursue their passion. But yet they found a way to do that. And what I learned from them is that far from passion being something that you either have or don't have, is that passion is something that you actively need to cultivate, that you actively need to maintain, that if you don't pay attention, it's going to drain itself. It's going to go away. And they're kind of like a flower that you need to tend to. Like, you got to tend to it regularly, you yourself, as well as obviously, like, the environmental conditions are going to have an impact on that. And so, like, that belief started forming in my mind, like this contrarian perspective. Wait a minute, like, the way we talk about passion is something that you have or don't have, something that you follow, that you need to discover, that's inside of you. That doesn't seem right with what I'm seeing in the world and with what I'm seeing with people who are successful in doing this. It doesn't quite gel with me. And so it is the case that everybody that I talked to had at one point fallen out of passion, but everybody had also then taken a lesson out of this, which is they could have gone the full cynicism route, where they would have fallen out of passion and then had other goals in life. And mind you, like, I want to highlight, that is a completely valid goal. Not everybody should pursue their passion. There's huge costs associated with the pursuit of passion that I'm sure we'll get to later in this podcast. But for those who want to pursue their passion and think that that's a goal that they want to pursue, it's not just something that you can do and hope that it goes well, like in the, you know, Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, if you do what you love, you'll never work another day kind of way. Like, if you do what you love, like, it's going to be a lot of hard work, and not because necessarily the work itself is going to feel hard all the time, but because the amount of management, self-management and other management you have to do in order to maintain that pursuit of passion is going to be really challenging. So that kind of perspective and belief, it started formatting in my mind. It's a long way of saying I figured out that one of the reasons why I had fallen out of passion with my own research, doing work on economic inequality, is that when you do work on inequality, fundamentally what you find out is all the ways in which the world is screwed up. Like, every single study shows you, here is yet another way in which the world is going to be really hard to change. Here's another, like, limiting factor of the deeply ingrained inequality and racism that is embedded in our structures, embedded in people's psyche and mindsets. It's going to make it really hard to change. And maybe if we're lucky, like, we're going to be able to move things like 2% at a time, you know, like these tiny effect sizes at best, because these things are just broader systems changes. And that, you know, the more I realized that as I was doing work, it was just really frustrating, like, to realize that no matter what I do, I'm never actually going to have a mark on society, that if I am lucky, it's going to be like a tiny, tiny dent in this space, but that really I'm not going to be able to change much. And so for me personally, I figured out that just doing work on inequality doesn't cut it for me, that while I care deeply about inequality and I want to do research on this, emotionally, I'm not cut out for it. I just can't do it. And so what I found out for myself is that what I need to do is I need to do two things at the same time, is that I study why people struggle in their pursuit of passion, like people who want to make the world a better place, want to do the kind of work that I'm doing, the kind of work that other people are doing. Like, why is it so hard for them? Why are they struggling? How can we design environment systems for people to make it easier to do that? How can I teach people to be better supervisors to those who are pursuing their passion? How can I teach people to manage their own pursuit of passion better? But if I only do that, that would also not be enough for me, right? So I like doing that. It's at the individual unit of analysis. It's great. I can work with people. I can actually think about what that means and empower people who want to make a difference in the world. But then it allows me to have the balance to then, you know, have a bit of positive experiences doing this kind of work, because ultimately figuring out how to help people make a difference in the world, which is like on the positive side. And then I can figure out more about why the word sucks and it's going to be really hard to change.
Yeah, it seems to be hard to be passionate about how horrible the world is. That is, you know, by definition, something that will drain your passion, no matter how hard you're working and how good you are at working. And it's just really hard, right? And so maybe there's something to be said for some level of, it's not naivete, but optimism or faith as an element of passion, right? You can't just be passionate about all things negative. Agency, some sense of agency.
Yeah, so I think the agency argument is important, but bear in mind that you can be passionate about things that are inherently frustrating. And it's not that you can't do that. It's just that you need to be aware of that. You need to understand the effect that it has on you, on your work, on your life, on your life outside of work. And that the demands that it places on you is something that are not negligible. There's this amazing paper by Winnie Jung that she published. I think it was an ASQ. She's an assistant professor over at INSEAD. And she looked at a number of people that worked, I believe it was in a refugee center up in New Haven. And, you know, usually when you have enough resources to deal with the influx of refugees that you expect, you're able to make a difference in people's world. And it's not quite as bad. Like, it's challenging. It's hard work. There are a lot of challenges that people who come into this country as a refugee have to face. And if your organization is set up to deal with a certain number of refugees every year, then more or less it's hard work, but you can get it done. What she looked at was a surge of refugees coming to the United States and how the workers in this refugee center actually tried to navigate what that meant when they're now no longer able to provide adequate work. And I think that is the challenging part, Eric, right? It's like when you're not able to make the difference that you would like to see in the world, when what you're passionate about, you know, you want to see X change, but at most you're going to see like 1/10 of that or even negative. Like, you feel like you're always falling short of that. And bear in mind, that's not even taken into account that when you're passionate about something, your expectations of what you want to see in the world is probably much, much higher anyway, because you see everything through these overly confident rosy glasses. Like, but it's hard if you fall short of that, right? And navigating that discrepancy between the change that you would like to see in the world and the change that you're actually going to be able to affect, that's going to be really hard and really struggling. And so I think that it is one of the key challenges that I think exists out there. Like, how do you deal with falling short on the change that you want to see, particularly when the issues that you're tackling are so multiply determined, particularly when there are broader systems at play that evade any individual's action to actually address. That is really challenging. Like, when it requires a concerted effort to fix a system that's been set up in a particular way for decades or centuries, I don't know about that, right? But I think you're absolutely right.
All right, let's get academic for a second. Your definition of passion.
My definition of passion. So yeah. My definition of passion, the way I think about passion, is it has three key components that on the one hand align it with some of the other constructs that are out there, but also highlight why I think it's unique and why I love studying it. So on the one hand, I think passion is a strong affect, an intense affective experience. Note that I don't say it's positive inherently. It's also not negative. It can be both, right? Like, when you're passionate about something, it can be really wonderful and you can feel really great about yourself, but it can also be a little negative, like when you're not necessarily having the difference you want to make or when you feel a little compelled to do things. So it is this intense affective state when you're passionate about something. The second component is that what you're passionate toward is about some value, something that is a bit more abstract, an identity relevant preference. So when I'm passionate about, say, teaching, what that means is I want other people to think of me or part of me as a teacher. It has this level of identity relevance. So it's oriented, this intense feeling, towards something that I personally care about. And then the third component that I think is really crucial is that it motivates you to engage in behaviors that reflect what it is that you care about. So when I'm passionate about, say, teaching, it motivates me to teach more. That's the idea. Like, it has this action orientation. And I think it's these three components that make passion so interesting and unique. Of course, it shares something from other emotions. Of course, it shares something from other motivations. Of course, it shares something from other identity constructs. But bringing these three things together into one distinct construct is, I think, what delineates passion so wonderfully.
Yeah, and this link is so crucial. This is almost the first thing that comes to mind when we think about passion. It motivates us to do things and increases our work performance, right? Talking about a business school setting. And there seem to be findings that, you know, by and large, between people, that might be true. However, you have sent me a paper of yours that presents some data that seems to be a little bit harder to reconcile with this narrative. So I wonder, just at a very high level, what were you looking at this paper? And
yeah, what did you find? Absolutely. So let me walk you through some of the main findings in the paper and why I think this paper actually is a really nice reflection of some of the underlying challenges that we have in the pursuit of passion. So in this paper, we ask the following question. We say, look, everybody glamorizes passion. We all aspire to it. Organizations, they increasingly call for it. They hire for it. They promote for it. So it should be an attribute that we all want, that everybody expects of us. But when you actually look at people who pursue their passion, like the people that are in professions that allow them to do that, people who say that they would like to pursue their passion or are pursuing their passion, and you look at whether or not this is an easy thing or a hard thing for them to do, as I alluded to earlier in my interviews, what you find over and over again is that people report a huge amount of challenges, that they say, this is actually really hard stuff. And one of the main things that they bring out is, you know, it's actually really emotionally exhausting to do this kind of work. And so in this research, we try to reconcile and try to understand, wait a minute, why is it that on the one hand, we all love passion and we think that we should all be passionate and we know that it's associated with all these good work-related outcomes. But then when you actually ask people what it's like when they are doing it, it is really difficult. And so the way that we understand this, we say, what actually happens every single day? Like, what does it mean to pursue your passion Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays and Fridays, day in, day out? How does your level of passion shape the way that you think about work, that you engage at work? And then how in turn does that affect how you might be emotionally exhausted and so on? And so the theory itself, it's not rocket science. It's actually quite straightforward, but it goes something along the lines of this. Let's say one morning, Monday morning, you wake up, you're really excited about the work that you have in front of you. Like, dare I say, like, you're passionate about the work that you have in front of you. Now, the challenge is when you're more passionate, you also feel like whatever demands come your way, you can deal with them. I'm going to rise to that occasion. I feel more empowered to be able to do that. So you rise to that occasion. You rise whatever demand comes your way, and you dedicate more of your time and more of your energy to whatever work happens today. And there's a ton of research actually showing that on days that people are more passionate for their work, they also, on average, work longer working hours. It makes a lot of sense. I'm more passionate. Work feels easier. Let me get more of that work done. The problem is what happens after work. So say I work, I'm more passionate, so it's going to be longer hours, and I come home. Now, because I've been so much more engaged into my work, I also have a harder time detaching from work in the evening. So even though now I'm at home, and home is where I recover, I detach, I engage in all of my non-work roles and responsibilities that I might have, I continue ruminating about work and thinking about the tasks that I did or that I failed to complete and I left for tomorrow. And in that lack of detachment lies that on the next day, I actually feel more emotionally exhausted because I haven't had the opportunity to recover from what actually was objectively a really challenging and energy draining experience. And so on days that people are more passionate for the work, on the subsequent day, because they have a harder time detaching from work in the evening, they're actually more emotionally exhausted. Now, we can also close that circle. When you're more emotionally exhausted for your work, what that means is that you have less emotional resources available to actually deploy to work. Now, because passion demands emotional resources from you and self-regulatory demands that it places on you, it also means that you're less able to deploy those in order to be passionate for your work. Like, even if you would like to be, you just don't have fuel in the tank anymore in order to do that. And so you're motivated actually in those moments, not necessarily to be passionate for the work, you're motivated to recover. And you're motivated to find ways in order to replenish those emotional resources that you actually had depleted on an earlier day. And so it's this really interesting reciprocal, almost cyclical thing, is that passion in and of itself, if you leave it unchecked, it depletes itself over time. You're more passionate, you give more of yourself, you become less detached from work. And the next day, you're more emotionally exhausted. Being more emotionally exhausted means that you're less willing or less able to actually dedicate emotional resources. Instead, you're motivated to find opportunities to recover. And unless you recover, you're going to have a hard time actually being sustainably passionate. And I think here is where something really important lies, which is that when you're passionate, you're not necessarily going to like plan opportunities to recover. And so if you don't pay attention, you're just going to drain yourself out until that passion is gone. And so we focus on this reciprocal dynamic here that really highlights, if you don't pay attention, your passion is going to drain itself over time. Now, I say like, if you don't pay attention, we also find what I think is this really cool phenomenon where we ask people in a second study, we ask them at the end of each workday, we said, hey, today, did you feel in control of your passion? Or did you feel like your passion controlled you? Some prior research that's called a harmonious internalization of passion or an obsessive internalization of passion. And what we found is that this link between passion and lower detachment was stronger for people who felt controlled by their passion. Now, I want to pause here for a second, because in a lot of prior literature and in the public domain, what we hear is that we should be driven by our passion. Is that the path to success is that we should give in to our passion and let our passion show us where we could end up. What we find is that people who feel compelled by their passion actually have a harder time detaching. And it doesn't make, like, it's not that difficult to see why. It's because you have a harder time detaching, right? Your passion controls you. Why would you detach? What I find even more interesting, though, is that people who feel in control of their passion at the end of each day, no matter how strongly they internalized, how strong their passion was on that day, they actually managed to detach from the work, no matter how strongly their passion was that day. So there's something that people who are able to control their passion do on any given day that allows them to keep some of the negative effects of passion at bay and reap the benefits of passion on any given day. But I will give one cautionary note, is it's not that people are better able on average to control their passion. That does not seem to moderate these effects. But that on any given day, your internalization of passion, whether you're able to control it or not, matters. What that means is, even if I, on average, might be better to control my passion, that does not necessarily mean that on any given evening, I felt that on that day I was able to control my passion. So there's something that we want to do more work on, try to understand, wait, what does it actually mean to feel like you're in control of your passion? And why are people not good at like being in control of their passion over time, because it doesn't seem to show up like that in our data. But I think more overarchingly, what we uncover here is that it's really hard to be passionate sustainably every single day, particularly if you're not in control or in charge of your passion. And that is something that is just completely inherent in what it means to pursue your passion every single day.
Wow. So I get up on Monday. I'm really excited. I'm passionate for work. I'm in grad school. I have to be passionate for work. I'm passionate about all these projects. I take on 10 million things. I teach. I do everything at the same time. It's 11 p.m. I've worked all day. I'm like, damn, that was a good day. Mm-hmm. Tuesday, I wake up and I realize, oh God, I'm not going to have another day like this, right? Today's Tuesday. I have to relax to the extent that I can. I take breaks. I don't really get anything done. And I'm maybe less productive at the end of Tuesday than I would have been if I had worked like half of Monday on both days, maybe to some way. Now you're saying this depends on how much time do I take to actually relax and recharge so my passion can come back, and how much I can control my passion. So what specifically, I know you just mentioned you wanted to follow up research on this, but I guess we can just speculate. What can I do on Tuesday so my passion is back on Wednesday?
I think I would focus on what you're doing on Monday. Like if A, on Monday, you're like working until 11 p.m., like it should come to no surprise that on Tuesday you're going to be more exhausted. And let me be clear, it's okay to work longer hours when you feel more passionate. But I think the challenge is in the expectations that we all have for the next day. Or I don't know, maybe, you know, you can do this for 2 or 3 days, but you can't do this. Like you can't work 80 hours a week, day in or day out. Like that doesn't quite cut it. And so I think the challenge lies in how you approach that Monday. Like either on that Monday you say, I know that, you know, on Tuesday I also have a lot of stuff I need to get done. So maybe I'm not going to work until 11. Or if you are going to work until 11, bear in mind that on that Tuesday or maybe on that Wednesday, you're going to need some time for yourself to recover. So you might want to have different expectations of yourself, as well as make sure that the people that you owe stuff to, owe the latest draft to, need to do, be a teaching assistant or grade papers or whatever other responsibilities you have, like, just to make sure that they are aware of the fact that things are going to take a little longer. And, you know, I think the challenge is that when on dates, when we are passionate, we're also overconfident of our own abilities. And maybe we set overconfident deadlines for stuff. Like, I can tell you how many times I've told co-authors, I'll send you something tomorrow because I felt like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get everything done. I'm going to crush it. And then obviously that doesn't happen. And so it's, you know, having that on the one hand, that level of self-insight, you know, of understanding that you might have to maybe cut your passion off and be controlled, but on the other hand, also changing the expectations for what it means on subsequent days. But you're right. I think one of the biggest things you can do is build in time for rest and recovery, whether that's within each day or just like on a different day. So embedded in one of the studies, we had a Labor Day weekend. Now, Labor Day, what I love about Labor Day in the US and what we actually show in the data is that Labor Day is unlike many other weekends in the United States. Labor Day is one of the few times when people actually engage in leisure activities and actually recover. And that, you know, like on most weekends, we all have some tasks we need to do. Like we have to clean the house, take care of kids. And I don't know what other things like, you know, are just like home related responsibilities. People also work on the weekends, you know, if particularly if they have to or they want to catch up on what's happened at work. So most weekends aren't necessarily all that replenishing. Like you can treat some weekends as a vacation. Colin West has this really fun paper in SPPS showing that you can do that. And when you do that, you recover well. But Labor Day weekend, it's different. People really spend time engaged in leisure time activities. And in the paper, we actually asked people to tell us how psychologically detached they felt after a normal weekend and how psychologically detached they felt after Labor Day weekend. And the D is one. Like the effect, like it's 0.99. Like it's a big effect size. Like I don't know when you ever see a D of one in the wild, but I was shocked at how big that effect size was. But it, you know, it makes sense. We looked at how people spend their time, and on a normal weekend, few people did a lot of leisure time activities, and on a Labor Day weekend, most people did a solid amount of leisure time activities that allowed them to replenish. And so, you know, like, am I making a case, an argument of the 4-day weekend? Not necessarily of the 4-day work week, like. Not necessarily. I think I'm making a case for people understanding that scheduling when and how you do work is actually really important. And that taking time off, it's not about finding balance. Like, I think that is not a helpful way of thinking about like taking time off. Taking time off helps you do your job. Like taking time off helps you be passionate for your work. Like, if you want me to be passionate about my work, like I might have to take some time off every now and then and like regularly. And that's actually what's important and so key.
It is this tempting logic where you run out of passion and energy, but not entirely. And you have these 10, 20% left in you on Monday evening at 7 p.m. You're like, I could grade those papers. I could have the energy. I do have maybe even some passion for it. I could do it now. And maybe to say, I am not going to do it now, because what a great start into my Tuesday if I start off doing something I've wanted to do for the whole night, for the whole evening. And yeah, I have some exactly. Energy, right? So maybe stop at 80% and 90% and don't wait till the very last percentage point of your passion is just spent on something.
So I'll tell you a story and an anecdote. The story is that my brother and I, we wanted to run a marathon many years ago when I was doing my undergrad. And this was like January 2013. I was in my last semester of undergrad. And I called my brother, and I said, hey, do you want to run a marathon? And he's older and we're a little competitive. And he said, sure. And I go online that evening. And that evening, I registered us for the Edinburgh Marathon, which was in May of that year. And I sent him an email and he calls me back. He's like, what the? Like, you signed us up for the marathon? And I was like, yeah, I signed us up for a marathon. He said, yes. He's like, I didn't actually think you would go through with it. Anyway, long story short, like neither of us has a lot of time to train because I was in my last semester of college and had a lot of work to do in order to make sure that I could graduate on time. My brother, because he was a resident on the ER that year and like just did not have a lot of time to run. So I think between us, we did like some runs, but not enough training. And we had told ourselves when we went on the marathon that we would start walking once we hit 85% exhaustion. So we would check in with each other. And once we hit 85% exhaustion, we would walk because we didn't want to get injured. You know, we wanted to be responsible adults. And so we're running, things are going well. I remember like mile 14, 15, I asked my brother how he's doing. He's like 80% exhaustion. Mile 17, we're hitting 80, you know, like 85% exhaustion. He's like, it's not that much further. Should we do 90%? He's like, yeah, let's do 90% exhaustion. So we continue running another half a mile. I'm checking in. He's like, yeah, I'm at 90% exhaustion. I'm like, should we do 95%? And like, we continue this game until we reach the finish line, not having walked. And on the way back, we had to take a bus back into the city because you run out of Edinburgh. It's really beautiful. And my brother, who mind you is a medical doctor, he looks at me and he's like, all right, I'm about to pass out. Here's what's going to happen. My eyes are going to close. You're going to put my feet up. You're going to find somebody on the bus here that has some gummy bears or other sweets. Feed them to me so I get some sugar. It's all fine. Don't worry about it. And then he passes out because we just pushed ourselves too far. But the way that this ties in with an anecdote is that we actually did research with the company this summer, this past summer, where we tackled the same problem, right? Where we looked at people who actually had a really hard time. This company was burning out at a really high level. And so we were doing research with this organization, and we asked employees, half of all employees, we randomly assigned them, and we said, look, tomorrow we want you all to take a short break within your workday. Whatever you do, you know, get away from your computer, go for a walk, have a cup of coffee, call somebody, like do something. And we want you to plan it now. Put it in your calendar, plan it now, and tell us exactly what you're going to do. So people faithfully did that. On the next day, you know, we were excitedly awaiting our data. We look at the data in the evening and we're shocked because we're like, wait, people didn't take their break. It turns out that 80% of people who had planned a break within work, a 5-minute break, Eric, they didn't take that break. And so we asked them on the next day, we're like, wait a minute, why didn't you, like, if you took a break yesterday, that's great. You know, tell us more about the break and how it made you feel. If you didn't take a break yesterday, why didn't you take a break? And people told us, I was worried about what other people would say. I was worried about my coworkers and my supervisor judging me for taking a short break because they would see it as a lack of dedication. And like, you know, my brother and I are not different from that. We wanted to continue going to show our dedication. We could run this marathon. And so the employees of this company, they also wanted to show, like, we wanted to be dedicated, but I want to change that mindset. Like, I really fundamentally want to change that mindset. If you're looking after yourself, It's not a matter of balance or anything like, you know, touchy-feely, ping, you know, like, uh-uh. It's none of that. If you want to be good at your job and you want to be passionate for your work, you need to look after yourself, like, period. And that means taking time off, taking breaks, imposing limits on yourself, managing other people's expectations. And we, as coworkers, co-authors, supervisors, we need to make sure that we don't perpetuate that toxic culture where we, like, ask people to work late every night, where we impose insane deadlines on others, where we strip agency away from people, where we tell them like to lean into their passion and let their passion drive them. I like, that is just a recipe for disaster. And like, I think if you look at a room of academics and they're like, yeah, like our culture is pretty toxic. And I think it's toxic because we rely so much on passion to drive us. We're really like, you know, we're all just burning out and trying to do our best along the way. So why don't we just treat ourselves a little better?
So you are German, I am German. Between the two of us and all our listeners, this is an American problem. You know, sometimes living here in America, I think these Americans are crazy, right? We Germans, within the European context, we pride ourselves on being the most workaholic people in Europe, which we could debate if that is even true. But you know, compared to Americans, we're so lazy or so good at taking care of our mental health, I guess. Is this passion narrative, does it unfold differently across cultures? And is this a uniquely American problem?
I think that's a fascinating question. I don't think we have a good amount of data. So I know there's this one cross-cultural study that came out in PNAS that looked at how people thought about passion and the importance of passion, that found some variation in how important people thought passion was. But it didn't necessarily focus on the question that you asked, which is like, how do people understand passion and its centrality? There's a number of speculations that I would make, but like I don't know how comfortable and confident I feel with that. I think one, there is a passion narrative in Germany, but that passion narrative is restricted to some industries and I think younger age groups. And I think There are industries like the startup industry, the tech industry, consulting, where Germany actually leads the world in working hours. Like, I remember when I worked at the Boston Consulting Group and I was at BCG, we all knew that the Germans worked the longest hours and that the Americans were the lazy ones. I think the other thing that is true about Germany and in particular, but other European countries as well, is that there is a strong focus on non-work life, that there is a strong focus on hobbies and like people fulfilling themselves outside of work. Whereas in the US, uniquely, we have a pressure to fulfill ourselves through our work, that our work is the primary and, dare I say, like the only valid way that you can make something of yourself, that you can live a quote unquote good life, like a life where you can have impact. And if you can only have impact through your work, like, of course, that's going to create a couple of very toxic situations. Whereas, you know, in other countries and in many European countries, there are other ways that you can make a difference that I think are not necessarily limited to work. But I don't want to put European countries on a pedestal here. I think there are other challenges within the pursuit of passion, outside of the pursuit of passion that European countries have. I don't think it's easy to pursue your passion in European countries. I actually think it's easier to get into professions that allow you to pursue your passion in the US than it is in European countries. Many European countries don't afford the same amount of job autonomy where you can engage in the kind of job crafting that would actually allow you to engage in more of the kind of work that allows you to reflect what it is that you care about. There is a greater emphasis on age being one of the key dimensions on which promotions happen and tenure that goes alongside it, which we have less of in the US. There's a certain degree of rigidity in thinking that doesn't necessarily allow for voices that are non-normative to speak up. And so there's a lot of other challenges to the pursuit of passion elsewhere. I think my favorite one is, so you see that the way that I express my passion is with a lot of effuse energy. And it's how I like to express my passion. I couldn't do that in Germany. Like if I did this in Germany, and you're laughing. Like if I did this in Germany, people would label me like at best American, you know, but like at worst crazy. And like not in a good way crazy, like crazy as in like I don't think I want to like hang out with you. And so there are certain norms, I think, in what legitimate ways to pursue and express your passion are that exist all over the world. I think in the US, one of those norms is working super long hours, and that's how it manifests. And, you know, constantly obsessing with pursuing your passion at work. And that's one of the norms that we have here in the US. And it has a lot to do with who we consider an ideal worker. And there's a whole literature, the ideal worker literature that talks and thinks about that. Whereas I think in other European countries, there are a number of other norms around what it means to pursue your passion. But like, there are like no one has done a ton of research on this. There's one other paper that Paulo Keefe did that was just published in the Journal of Organizational Behavior that compared the pursuit of passion across, I believe it was a Chinese sample, a Dutch sample, and an American sample. But I might be wrong. All that is to say, there's a huge like rife amount of research to be done on the cross-culturalness of what it actually means to pursue your passion. And what I think most interested in is the norms that surround the pursuit of passion of what is normative and what is expected, like around the world, like on the European continent, the Asian continent, African continent, like what it looks like in Latin America. Like we don't know anything.
Wow. So we've talked about passion and work. But as you say, life is more than work, it turns out. And so there might be passion outside of work to be found. And I'm thinking of a friend of mine who, she loves writing. All she does in her free time is write. She loves writing. So I was asking her, well, do you want to become a writer? And her response was, absolutely not. That's the last idea I would appreciate and follow up on. And I was like, well, don't you want your work to be your passion? And she was like, I don't want my passion to be work. Right? I just want to be left alone. And if my passion becomes my work, then my motivation gets crowded out. I just do it for the money or the fame. I have deadlines. I want this to be my own thing outside of work. So how do you think about passion at work versus in other domains? And is there a certain like crowding out of passion once you make your passion your work?
Let me be clear. It doesn't matter where you pursue your passion. You can pursue your passion at work. And that is one domain in which you can pursue your passion. And that's totally fine. And we need to understand that there are certain limits to what that actually looks like, meaning there are some professions that allow you to pursue your passion. Those professions come with a certain number of expectations and norms that may or may not necessarily reflect the kind of work life that you want to have. There's certain salaries associated with occupations and professions that don't necessarily allow everybody to engage in the pursuit of passion at work. And there are certain working conditions that are somewhat more exploitative that don't necessarily gel with everyone's understanding of what they want at work. And so if you are like not able to because the salaries aren't high enough and you need to provide for your family, or you just have a different sense of what lifestyle you want to lead, then that's okay. You don't have to pursue your passion at work. If there's something about the norms associated with that particular lifestyle, like if you work like in the restaurant industry because you want to be a cook, like those working hours and working conditions are going to be really tough. Okay, so maybe you don't have to be a cook, and that's totally fine. Like, we should legitimize that. That's a completely valid and totally okay way to do that. But I mean, we don't do that, you know. Or I don't know, if you don't like the uncertainty in the stream of income or the amount of money that you earn, say as a musician, if you happen to be passionate about music, okay, like then you don't have to do that. We can admire people who do, and we can admire people who don't. Like, but there's a certain valor that we place here on people who pursue their passion at work that I think is entirely unwarranted. And mind you, it excludes a lot of people. Like, if you come, if your SES background isn't all that rosy, like, and your parents didn't have a huge amount of money either to allow you to develop your interest in music or art, you know, because it's expensive to do that, or because, you know, that's just not a realistic option because you have to provide for your family or your community, that's great. And like, why should we guilt people into not pursuing their passion at work? Like, we shouldn't say that that's a bad thing. And likewise, like the working hours expectations excludes people with greater childcare responsibilities who don't necessarily have the ability to do that. Anyway, all that is to say, I think we it doesn't matter where we pursue our passion. There's a certain premium that we place, particularly in the United States, on pursuing your passion at work. But I think it's fundamentally exclusionary at best. And at worst, I think it's actually reifying underlying inequalities that only exacerbate gender differences and economic differences. And now you see my interest in inequality coming into play here. All that is to say, like, you can pursue your passion outside of work and lead a wonderful life. And the way that I think about this is to think about the portfolio approach. So there's this model in financial economics that's probably outdated, but I remember learning about it in undergrad. It's called the CAPM model. The CAPM model basically says that the best way to balance risk and reward is, rather than investing in one company, you invest in a number of different companies that happen to balance out each other's risks, such that if you take like an aggregated average of all these companies that you're invested in, you have a good amount of reward with the lowest amount of risks. And CAPM model, as far as I remember from undergrad, actually does a really nice job on outlining the underlying mathematics of this approach. We could apply this idea of a passion portfolio to our own lives. Okay, so I can pursue my passion at work, but I need to understand that that means that my work life might be a bit more volatile and demanding. So maybe I need to do something in my life to balance that out. Or like, maybe I don't pursue my passion at work. It fulfills other needs like safety, security, financial needs, relational needs. Maybe I really like my coworkers. That's great. And then I'm going to pursue like one of my passions outside of work and balance these things out. And mind you, like, people have many things that they're passionate about. And if you like have one thing, like if like your job is now the only place that you pursue all of your passions, like, Eric, what happens when your job doesn't go well? Like, your whole life is, you're going to start questioning your whole life. And I think in some regards, it reminds me a lot of Eli Finkel's work on the all or nothing marriage, right? This idea that even when we now look at our partners, we're hoping that our partners are now able to meet every single one of our needs, when like that's also not quite true. Like, we have a bunch of different relationships in our lives that are able to meet the very needs that we have. In the same way, I think we have a bunch of different things that we care about, a bunch of different passions. And we are like, I think what I would argue for, like, let's find a way to live a life that allows you to fulfill the things that you care about and the things that you're passionate about. Boom. Like, whether it happens at work or not doesn't matter. As long as it also meets your other needs for, like, your relational needs, financial needs, security needs, your aspirational needs, your status needs. Like, I think that is a much more valid way of thinking about what it means to live a life. But I think the challenge is that we live in a cultural context that places a premium on pursuing your passion at work, and that that places pressure on people to do that. And I think that that makes it really challenging for people to actually pursue their passion in a sustainable way.
Or even more deeply, to pursue our passion for some profit or for some version of productivity. So I learned how to play the piano when I was in second grade, and then stopped playing when I was, like, finishing high school. And it didn't stop. I was always passionate about it. I loved playing the piano. It was fun to play with people together. And then I stopped playing when I went to college, not because I had to suppress my passion. I just fell out of passion, right? I just didn't enjoy it anymore for some reason, whatever the reason is. And people were so concerned with me. They were like, oh my God, you've spent so many years playing the piano and there's no productivity linked to it. You haven't made money with it. You're not good. It's not going to help with your profession in academia. Why did you do it? And I was like, well, it was good while it lasted, right? Passions come and go. And if they're wonderful and they help you along the way, they don't have to serve some sort of external purpose. They don't have to be profitable in some way. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. So two things. I think one of the things that strikes me, the way that you're talking about it, I think there is a disconnect. The way that we talk about passion and the way that I think we should think about passion. The way that you just talked about your passion is you focused on a concrete behavior. You said, I was passionate about playing the piano. I actually don't think that's possible. I think that when you're passionate about something, it reflects something that you care about, right? So what did playing the piano play to you? Now, I'm not a therapist. This is not going to be a therapy session, but I think that it is interesting. Like, if you reflect, or like, what did playing the piano mean for you? Was it a way for you to live out your creativity? Was it a way for you to actually be alone with your own thoughts? Was it a way for you to gain self-efficacy and you really like yourself getting better at something until you reach some kind of level? That's great. Once you figure out, like, what that value is that you're actually aspiring to, then you're actually able to understand that there's a number of different behaviors that you can engage in instead of playing the piano that still fulfills what it means to be passionate about something. I'll give you an example. So again, when I was in grad school, I was falling out of passion, yada, yada, inequality, tough, passion, great, doing both at the same time, important. Even that was not enough. Like, I was a demanding, very annoying grad student that was constantly dissatisfied. I always joke, Elke actually ended up leaving for Princeton and Adam Galinsky ended up becoming my advisor at Columbia. And Adam and I, we always joke, like, I made a terrible grad student. I think, like, I'm a much happier faculty member than I was a grad student just because I always felt so limited in what I was able to do. But I remember struggling with Adam at one point because I told Adam, listen, Adam, I really want to teach. Like, I really want to teach. But I'm not able to because in our PhD program, the best we could do was be a TA. And being a TA was not actually teaching and being in the moment. And Adam said, great, like, find a way to teach and see what that's like. And I thought, you know, the way I thought about teaching is I had to be in a classroom and teach students. And that's what I really cared about. It turns out that what I really care about is connection and, like, helping other people grow and develop, and not necessarily, like, me focused, I want to teach, but connecting with other people and allowing them to develop and grow. And so I ended up, at the time in New York, part of the way in which I fulfilled that value of connection was also being a salsa dancer, which I love. And I could talk your ear off if you wanted to. But part of what I found out is, hey, I can actually teach salsa at Columbia. And so I did teach salsa. Not a lot, mind you. Like, I wasn't good enough to be, like, a regular teacher. But as a sub, every now and then, I was able to teach. And, like, my God, like, that feeling of connection when I was able to teach and show people and, like, and share my love for salsa dancing and seeing people get better at this, like, it fulfilled that passion, you know, and it made me realize, wow, like, there's a number of ways that I can fulfill this. It doesn't have to be me standing in a classroom. Like, there's many other ways in which I can fulfill that passion. And so, sorry, that's to your first point when you're like, I'm passionate about piano. I actually think there's a lot of other things. I think the second point of, like, do I need to turn it into money? The challenge is I think the pressure that you're putting yourself under. And I think your friend is right on the money. When you put this in the money domain, you're also opening yourself up to a different kind of negative feedback, right? Like when you're passionate about something in a non-monetary domain, the feedback that you care about is whether you like doing it, maybe whether you're good at it, whether you can share it with others who are also passionate about the same thing. And that's it. When you try to make money out of it, you're also placing it on the market. And now market norms kick in that evaluate you and your work vis-a-vis other people's work. And now your work is being evaluated by a whole array of people who will put a price tag on what you produce. And that's hard because when it doesn't go so well, it now has you questioning whether you're good. It has you questioning whether you're spending your time well. It has you questioning whether like this is even something that someone like you should do. You know, like, so it's, I think it becomes challenging because then you ultimately end up being in a competition with other people because now you're on open market. But when you're pursuing your passion and it does not monetary, like there's no competition. Like the competition is you, you know, and like your own expectations, which may or may not be hard, but that's great. But placing yourself in competition on the open market with other people where you sell your skills to others, I don't know, like that sounds a little challenging to me.
All right. So we have talked a lot about people who have too much passion and who maybe have to regulate their passion or be in control of their passion. What about people who feel like they don't have a passion for anything? They're not passionate about, do these people exist? Do they just have to find their passion? What is your advice for them?
Oh gosh. So, it is interesting. I think early on in my research, I was most fascinated by this question. And it's interesting. My research itself has actually moved away from that question. Not because I don't think it's a valid question to ask, but because I think it's a really challenging question to study. And I think the reason is that what you're essentially focusing on here is not whether or not people have a passion, because again, you know, I think that's too concrete of a way of thinking about it, but how people find out what it is that they care about. And that is a much longer journey, you know, when you're thinking about it. Like now we're talking about constructs like self-insight, self-concept clarity. We're talking about self-expansion, right? We're talking about people's understandings of their self. And there's a whole literature, like self and identity literature that seeks to explain that. It seeks to make sense of the multiple identities people develop and discover. And so I think to answer your question, rather than going the roundabout way, I think of course, like there are people who haven't found out what it is that they care about. There are people who go through life without ever questioning what it is that they care about, or who have life events that force them to reevaluate what it is that they care about. But there's also people who find out what it is that they care about and who have to make sense of what that means, right? And what it is that we care about can change. And that can sometimes be really challenging from one's own identity, right? To accept like what it means actually to have something that you once cared about being no longer something that you care about, and vice versa, something that you never used to care about now being something that you care about. So this notion of like who we are, like this me thing, like as a static thing with clearly defined values, I think it's an interesting question. It's not a question that I myself am currently studying just because I think it's a very thorny and challenging question. And I know there's people who are far more talented and skilled in thinking about this question, currently tackling it.
As you say, it is one thing to know what you're passionate about. It is quite another to have the luxury to pursue your passion, right? So tying this back to inequality, I am talking to undergrads here at Stanford who tell me I'm majoring in finance and I hate it, but at least it'll give me a career where I have money and I can support my family, right? It's not just so I can buy an expensive car. I can support my family. I have to sacrifice my passion for it. And as you're saying, there's a lot of passion shaming almost, right? For those people who are not pursuing their passion. What are they doing? Why would they care about their family when they could be pursuing their passion? There's a certain socioeconomic status dimension to it, status dimension to it, privilege dimension to it. And I wonder if you have any, probably a lot of thoughts that you want to share on this and on the passion shaming along status lines.
Yeah. So, okay. It's a bit of a complex question because I think there's a number of different strands to pull here. I think one of them is there are some people who want to focus on financial returns as part of their career. And that is totally legit. In fact, the effective altruism movement highlights that one of the best ways that we can make a difference in the world is to find a way to make a lot of money and donate a lot of it to an effective charity. And so, yes, that is totally legit. And yes, there are people who have financial constraints who really just need to focus on making a return and need to focus on providing for their families. Absolutely. And I don't want to leave Stanford undergrads off the hook like this. and undergrads at other colleges and other universities, because I think there's two components to it that I think are important. The first is, if you ask them, they care about other things in addition to making money too. It's not just that they say, I only care about making money, and that's the only thing that I care about in this world. In fact, if they did say that, I would be extremely worried. and I think that's a very different kind of conversation to have with them. But what I worry about is that because we as humans have many things that we care about, and let's say that the one thing that I end up focusing on and prioritizing is making a financial return, whether it be constraints or whether it just be personal preference, that is totally fine. The challenge is that once I leave college and I enter environments that I select into, that other people have selected into because of a financial preference, where I'm now surrounded by other people, where financial preference is the one thing that binds us together, where people who don't care so much about money actually end up dropping out, and where people who care a lot about money end up being promoted. Now, if I do this for a couple of years, I am being surrounded by people who demonstrate that they care a lot about money, and that can warp my own values. It can warp what it is that I care about, right? Like, there's this saying, you're the average of the five people that you spend the most time with. And I think the challenge is that when you enter a profession based on like one thing, and you know, in this case, it can be a financial preference, you end up being surrounded by people who have also made that choice and surrounded by people who are sticking with that choice and haven't left the organization, haven't left that field yet. And so what I see in MBA students is they say, you know, I would love to make a difference in the world, but right now I can't. So I'm going to make some money for a couple of years, pay back those loans. And in 5 years, I'm going to quit and I'm going to do the, you know, like I'm going to take the lower paying job and make a difference in the world. In 10 years, I'm going to do that. And then they reach the point and it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because what they cared about changed. It can also have changed because life circumstances have changed. Like, you know, they have families, their parents are ailing, they have a different connection with their community. And so I don't necessarily think, again, that that's a bad thing, but that there's these intertemporal choice problems. And, you know, with us being different people in the future than we are today, that I think makes it really challenging when people say, I'm going to do this for 5 years until I've made enough money, and then I'm going to do something else. And I think that is unrealistic. And I think that is what I think is so problematic, where people's values and sense of who it is that they are and what they care about, that can change. The second thing that I do, I think, believe that people who have access to elite networks and who are in a privileged position, and Stanford undergrads qualify for both of that. And I think many other people do. It's like there's a certain level of responsibility, I think, that comes with having access to elite and with having privilege. I think it comes with that responsibility, and people who shirk that responsibility to do something with that, I don't know, like that becomes a personal value and a personal preference of mine. Like, we should all do something with the access, with the preference and the privilege we have. Because otherwise we're just reifying underlying inequalities and further exacerbating the challenges that we have in front of us. What that looks like, I think, is something that people need to decide for themselves, right? I mentioned like one way to do that is make a ton of money and donate a ton of money to charity. One way you can do that is to actually go in and try to make a difference in the world. And mind you, like, it's a really hard way. Like, again, like that's when the pursuit of passion hits, like inequality hits, like you're going to see hardship on a day to day. You're going to feel like you're falling short of your ability to deliver on what it is that you actually want to deliver on. I wrote a case about this former MBA MPP grad, Kwame Owusu-Okese, who he's 10 years out, and he just became the CEO of this organization called the Harlem Children's Zone. The mission of the Harlem Children's Zone is to redress systematic racial inequality, initially focused on 97 blocks in Harlem, in New York, where they engage in place-based services. So they do educational offerings, health offerings, transportation offerings. They do everything. Like, they touch every single aspect of children's lives and adolescent lives, as well as of other community members, their parents, and so on. It's really remarkable work. They've been going on for 30 years, have shown amazing results. But he becomes the CEO, and, you know, he now has the question in front of him, like, do we go national? We can attract additional funding and do more. Should we do more? And of course, you know, if you're a person who wants to make the world a better place and is passionate, like, of course you're going to say, yes, I should do more. But that also means you're going to be more exhausted. You're going to see more hardship. You're going to have a harder time falling short of your aspirational goals. And so making a difference itself is really hard. And so the other thing you can do is find ways that you can support people who are making a difference, like be it at work or outside of work, like creating the right environments for people to do that, getting engaged in your local community, getting engaged in organizations that are doing that. And I think there's a, as you know, I love German words. So I'm going to two German words that I think people learn. One of them that I think really reflects how I think about passion that I don't think is the right way of thinking about passion, but I think is a complementary way of thinking about passion, complementary to the way that we think about in the US. So the US way, passion is something that is amazing and something that, you know, if you pursue it, it's going to be great and easy. I think the German word for passion, Leidenschaft, it literally translates to the ability to endure hardship. So if you're passionate about something in German, you do it not because it's necessarily fun, but because you care about it. And the day-to-day might actually be really challenging, but that's okay as long as every now and then you have some successes and some wins. So that's the first way that I think, the first word I think we should all learn. I think the second word is we do not all need to be so-called Weltverbesserer. A Weltverbesserer is a German word, translates to a world-making betterer. It's a person who looks at the challenges in the world and who takes it upon themselves to try to themselves fix everything. Okay. Now, the way that Germans talk about Weltverbesserer, like they think that they're kind of naive, you know, that they don't really understand the real world out there. What I'm trying to say is like, we don't all have to be Weltverbesserer. Like what it means to pursue your passion is not that you need to tackle the big challenges of our time, but instead to carve out like your small little niche. And that might also just be surrounding and supporting the people like in your own environment. Like, you know, like you, if you help a person make a difference in the world, then you have helped make a difference in the world. But that might look different for different people and what it actually means to help them make a difference in the world and to help them pursue their passion. So that's why I'll go back to this notion of a passion portfolio. Like there's many different ways that you can pursue your passion. We should think about the different risks that everyone has, the different demands that every way that you can pursue your passion has. And not all of it has to be through work or through one big thing. It can be a lot of different things that address all of our different needs and wants and desires.
Yeah, it goes back to our sense of agency where we started off this conversation, right? Your passion will burn you out if you have high expectations of all the things you will achieve within a week and then you'll move on. When oftentimes these can be naive or even arrogant, right? I will change the world within the next year. No, you won't, right? And so...
it's hard. Like, it's really hard to reconcile that. Like, don't we all want to make a difference in the world, Eric? Like, aren't we academics because we think that we want to make the world a different place? I remember, I published my first paper on inequality in grad school, and it continues to be one of my all-time favorite papers. Focuses on the importance of community building for low-income individuals and how we should invest more in local community building, but we're not. And I remember the paper came out. I thought it was an amazing paper. I'd spent so much time doing the field work. I was in Bangladesh collecting data. I did lab studies. I did this. I did that. So much work. I did a paper, came out, and I was waiting for things to change. Like, I kid you not, I was like sitting at the edge of my seat. I was like going on Google News, like looking up stuff. I was like, you know, when are things going to change? I was like emailing people my paper, like not even academics, like non-academics. I was like, you know, we should change community building. And nothing happened. Like nothing happened. And I remember I went to one of the faculty in my department, Joel Brockner, and I said, hey, Joel, I wrote this paper. When are things going to change? Like when? And he said, you know, if you're lucky and you spend a lot of time studying one topic, maybe someone somewhere is going to have changed their mind because of what you did. And you need to be okay with that. Like that is what it means to be an academic, is that if you're lucky and you do something for a really long time, maybe someone somewhere is going to change their mind at best. And that's what it means to me. I wish someone had told me that before I went to grad school. Like, not because I don't think it would have changed my decision to go to grad school, but I think it would have set my expectations better. And I think we need to tell people like this is what it means to go to grad school. You're not going to change the world, but maybe someone somewhere is going to change their mind as a result of what you do. But I think it's helpful to calibrate that there are many ways that you can make a difference, and that like writing papers might not even be the most effective one.
Sadly, we are running up against time, and I feel like this is a wonderful way to end. I just want to thank you again for being on the show and taking the time. And please, if you have any last words you want to share with our audience, please let us know. But either way, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Eric. Okay, shameless plug time. Very shameless plug time. There are not many people who are studying why people struggle to pursue their passion. I would like to find more people. And so if you happen to find yourself interested in trying to understand why people struggle to pursue their passion, and you want to empower people making a difference in the world and become better Weltverbesserer, and you want to learn more German words, like, be in touch with me. I'm looking for people who are interested, particularly people who are interested in within-person perspectives, in experience sampling approaches, and ecological monetary assessment approaches. I think that's the way to go in this literature. There isn't a lot of people doing this. And I say that, like, I don't know who else outside of me is doing that. There might be people out there. So come out of the woodworks, get in touch with me. I'd love to work with you. There are tons of companies that are wanting to do this work, non-for-profit organizations, government organizations, public service organizations, individuals themselves that are struggling with the pursuit of passion. I actually think, and maybe this is me being a bit grandiose, but I think that people struggling to pursue their passion is one of the biggest challenges of our time. I think that there are so many people who would like to pursue their passion, but who either because they don't necessarily have the right belief of what it means to pursue their passion, or because they become cynical once they fall out of passion, actually stop doing that. And I think that our organizations are not set up to support people's pursuit of passion. I actually think the way that we currently have it set up is very toxic. And if anything, drains people of their passion. And so if you want to be involved in helping, like, create better systems and environments and organizations that actually support people's pursuit of passion, that empowers people to make a difference in the world, like, join me, email me, tweet at me, talk to me, find me at SPSP or otherwise, and let's make the world a better place.
Amen. Wow. Way to end. Thank you again. Wonderful.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you so much for listening. We would love to hear what you think of this episode, or if you have any other suggestions for future guests or topics for the podcast. You can reach us at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. You can also connect with us on Twitter at stanfordpsypod. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere so more people can find us. Thank you so much.